It is, of course, for somebody of my generation, interesting to read about a narrative from the perspective of a young woman. But equally, Lambert and other characters, the cook, I've forgotten her name,
Ginny,
are interesting characters. And in a way, you are paying a price, I feel, in having the narrative based on a young woman, which is inevitably, being young, a narrow perspective. And I would like to encourage you to somehow retain the insight of the perspective from a young person, but put some emphasis on some of the other characters. I feel a lack of balance to a reader like me, which is, of course, just an individual.
I can totally understand. When I stopped halfway through the book and read through it again, I had originally written it from the first person, in the first person, from Lara's point of view entirely, and I really, really felt the sort of closeness of it and the claustrophobic nature of it, and I changed it into the third person, but kept the perspective from Lara. So even though it's in the third person, you still feel that Lara is speaking. And I did at that point wonder if I shouldn't give Lambert his own voice. And it didn't ever occur to me to give any of the other characters, but I thought maybe I could have it from both their voices. As a writer, I tend mostly to stick from writing from one perspective in a book. And some writers, you know, someone will come in and serve tea and suddenly you'll hear everything in their head. But I just felt, I had an experiment with it and I gave Lambert some of his opinions, but it didn't quite work. But I know what you mean, and I'd love to have been able to do that, but I just didn't feel that it worked as well, because for Lara, it's such a mystery, really, in her life who Lambert is, that if we know who Lambert is, then that story doesn't work so well. And the whole idea I'd had to start with sort of falls apart. And often it's where you start with. In The Sea House, I have three or four narrators of different ages, different sexes. But I knew I was going to do that right from the beginning. So it was great. And I loved doing it. And I loved the challenge it set me. But in this book, it's like it wasn't how I started. And at that point, I didn't feel I had quite what it took to start again. And often books sort of form themselves like that. But I do take your point.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed hearing that conversation. I have to confess I'm a psychoanalyst too, and I can't help it when I'm reading novels not to put a kind of Freudian take on it. You know, for example, if I'm reading Jane Austen, to kind of look at the development of her thinking in terms of the major kind of theories of Freud, which is a bit much. But I mean, there were many, many, many aspects of this book which were so refreshingly kind of straightforwardly kind of fit with kind of psychoanalytic ideas. You know, I mean, the treatment of sexuality and the repression, but the excitement, the shame, the anxiety, all kind of welded together. And similarly, the issue that you explained about self-awareness in the rape scene, for want of a better word. But I wanted to ask you a bit about the theme of incest, which is also there, which of course is a kind of central kind of theme, and perhaps you could say something about that.
In a strange way, I was going to make this. The theme was going to be a much bigger theme in the book, but once the situation with Roland, the kind of sexual assault of rape, it's almost like it becomes slightly secondary. And that was the price the book paid for that happening, whereas the other theme was going to grow and become the main theme. And it definitely is overlooked in a way, often in a discussion. But what I was playing with was that amazing feeling of recognition you have when you fall in love, when you meet someone that you just click with. And the horrible idea that's put into her head that maybe he's actually her half-brother, in everything we know about also having that recognition when you meet someone who is related to you that you've never met before, you get that shocking kind of familiarity. And so I was really working on that theme. And also a feeling for her, feeling that everything she was feeling was not true and worthless, because in fact, maybe it was, you know, not real. It wasn't love. It was just somehow genetically she was reacting. So I was sort of playing with all those things. And that was something I knew I was going to do early in a way that I didn't know. I was going to make that other scene with Roland so central. And yeah, it's interesting. I mean, coming from a very large family myself, I've had that experience of meeting a sibling, a half-sibling that I hadn't ever known, hadn't grown up with, and feeling the extraordinary jolt, as if I was like, actually, once I sort of just sort of jolted back. It was to see someone so familiar. And so I sort of wanted to investigate that feeling. That's probably why I put it in there.
I just find myself curious about what writers you like to read.
I like to read so many different, less writers. Like if I read a book by someone I really like, I don't necessarily immediately find another book by them. I read in quite an arbitrary way. An odd thing, you just sort of see a book and you often know you're going to like it. That thing about judging a book by its cover. You often just do have a feeling about a book or by what you know about an author maybe. I guess I absolutely loathe crime. Someone sent me a book today. It was like the new crime fiction. I sort of threw it down, thinking, why would they think I would want to read that? And I sort of felt almost quite hostile towards it. I want a book that reflects things to me that I haven't ever quite been able to form into words, but I've felt and thought, and not a book about with a really driven plot that sweeps me along too quickly to digest what's being explained or reflected in the middle. That's the kind of book I really don't like. And I like to read sort of writers that I always will read, Helen Dunmore, Julie Myerson, Rachel Cusk, of my generation, Jonathan Coe. But then just... there's so many amazing books out there. Pretty open to... I get sent a lot of books, so quite often I'm not really absolutely choosing what I'm reading. It's sort of thudding onto my doormat, and then there's a great pile, and I finish one, and I think, oh, and I sometimes find something absolutely amazing just in that way.
For me, I found it a very interesting picture of the social... background of England. I mean, I found an echo of Sylvia Plath among the people that she couldn't get to, and that sort of discouraged her. I also found a kind of kinship between the hunger that was being expressed and the lack of empathy that was coming from everyone else. This is not to do with the main character, but more in terms of the father, because he's always sort of in the background of your books, and he's always a mystery. But for the first time in this one, I began to understand him a bit. And at the end, you sort of pull it all together, because he went to be with Caroline, because as he says, she was the only one who helped him when his parents were in trouble. And I mean, that sort of, it was such a statement for me. It made sense to me of the father.
I don't know. Thank you. I think that there was one of the reasons why, you know, the man earlier asked me the question of, you know, giving the father a voice. It was because I knew that I wanted to try and resolve why he was such an absent person and had hidden himself away emotionally to such an extent that he had this sort of past that he'd never been able to be open and public about, because he felt so ashamed and so worthless, not having been able to save his parents, that then I felt that his voice would almost not tell us anything anyway, because he wasn't someone honest in his emotions. I mean, I know quite a lot of people like that, and it's very interesting to observe them and to see how people have dealt with those pasts. And it is something that, you know, has come up several times in my books, because even though my father came to this country as an emigre and not as a refugee, and his family did come with him, it still had a huge effect on our family. It's like there's a line that was drawn between the past and the future. And the line was silence. And, you know, that moment when life was completely altered forever, you know, had a tremendous, profound effect on who my father and his brothers and his family became, and therefore who his children became. And it took me to being a writer and showing that I was genuinely interested and not just prying somehow to even get any information. So although Lara's experience is much more extreme, that she discovers that, you know, there is no family left, and that he was unable to get his parents out, and that wasn't, you know, my own experience. But still, the amount of silence around just the fact that my father didn't want to be associated with, you know, the victims, and he didn't want to be ghettoized, he didn't want to be these people. Never a mention of being, you know, Jewish, being having struggled, people who didn't get out, just never a mention of it. It took me a very long time to sort of almost have the courage to mention it and myself, and to own it, and for it to be part of my heritage. So I'm very interested in those things. And also my father's best friend, the artist Frank Auerbach, came here on the Kinder transport and never saw any member of his family ever again, someone we've known, you know, most of my life. And his, apparently, his take on this is that it was very liberating. He didn't have anyone to answer for. He didn't ever say this to me, so this isn't a direct quote, but that's what I've been led to understand. And I think, hello, you know, is that it? And, you know, so it's really just showing in a way how different people will make what they make of the past, and how the next generation have to sort of unravel it or not. I mean, I don't see all of my siblings unraveling it, but for me, it's been very important. Absolutely, always in my mind, I wanted to be connected to my family, and that was not possible for a very long time. Whereas not everyone feels that need in the same way. And I sort of did it through writing and feel, especially my third book, where I investigated sort of relatives of my father's mother's family in the First World War, and kind of brought the family forward. And it was amazing, because it's like I kind of brought them all towards me and educated myself at the same time. And resolved a lot of things.
How did you feel about having your book Hideous Kinky made into a film, and how do you feel generally about books going into films?
I was pleased, actually. There are so many people who don't read, and so many more people who watch films. And so suddenly your books are spreading out to a hugely wider audience who, it's not like they're going to then not bother to read the book, because they probably weren't going to read it anyway. And what I felt very lucky about with my film was that I had a really, really sympathetic script writer, the whole team, because it was so obviously autobiographical. They were so keen that, you know, I was on board, my mother and my sister as well. So they really included us in the process of it. And also, in order to get the money to make the film, they couldn't make the film from the point of view of a child as I had written it. It's a five-year-old child telling the story. So they had the film from the point of view of the mother, because they had to have they couldn't have Kate Winslet playing a bit part. They had to have her playing the lead, or she wouldn't do it and they wouldn't get the money. And so the film is different enough from my book to make me feel that actually it's still quite a different experience reading the book. You can still say to someone, if you like the film, read the book, it won't be the same. And also, I just love the little girl. For anyone who's seen it, the little girls who play the children are just, I'm so lucky. They are just so delightful, and I couldn't have been better served by them. So I was lucky. And films generally, things almost, you know, there are scouts out there who read every book that's published, I think, and see, will it make a film? Will it make a film? It's this huge business. And it's very lucky for the authors, because you feel money for nothing. They option it, you get some money. Chances are they'll never make it. But, you know, you get the option money. So everyone's thrilled. And I wonder when suddenly this business will come to a grinding halt. But I have written scripts for various of my books and adapted them. And I found that really, really frustrating. One, you've already written it, so you're quite bored. Two, you think, oh, this will be easy because I've done it. And then you find it's really difficult. And then they never make it. So, you know, I've just vowed I will never do it again. And someone else is adapting Love Falls. Someone actually who lived by chance happens to have just moved to Italy. And so, you know, let's hope he does a good job. Let's see.
You're very honest about how much you draw on your autobiographical material. And I just wonder how people in your world, in your family and friends, react to this, and whether it's been overall supportive or if you've had problems there.
Did you say honest? Very honest, did you say?
I say you've been very honest.
I wasn't sure if you said earnest, just to make sure. Yes, I do. Well, actually, most writers always say, no, I don't, how dare you? And people are quite nervous about asking. But it just seemed pointless when it's so clear that I do to entirely refuse to admit that I do. And I hate to argue, so I just decided to say, yes, I do use my own life, and to a large extent, and I use it often as a starting point or weave it in. They say, you know, a writer in the family is the end of the family. It's not the case, luckily, but it's not easy. And I find that I'm a much more ruthless person as a writer than I ever imagined I would be, because my desire to make the story work, even if it means using something that's quite painful to somebody else, is, you know, sometimes overridden. And I've been lucky, though, with my family, because I know some families just absolutely couldn't accept it and feel completely devastated. But my father completely accepts that, you know, well, not that he has no right to say anything, but that, you know, he accepts that I'm doing something that I need to do creatively, and that that's what I need to do. You know, that's it, simple as that. I mean, in my second book, it's quite probably the most sort of gloomy of my books. You know, it's about a very troubled teenager and her very distant and really hopeless father and fairly hopeless mother and everyone. And he said, oh, I'm so sorry, I had no idea you were having such an awful time. And I said, no, I wasn't really. I just, some of those things, you know, I could draw on, but, you know, the thing is, they saw me and I was also having a wonderful time. You know, that's the thing is, I suppose they know the truth. And he did say, I was a bit worried about a father character. And then I thought, oh no, but I don't wear a watch. And I just thought, that's such a great attitude. You know, I just disguised him a little bit. I gave him a watch. That was it. So, you know, you could almost, you know, so many people, if I run writing workshops or anything, or talk to writers, often what stops them in writing is that first book that they need to get out of their system, which is often something that's really lodged sort of quite painfully inside them, and they need to get it out for whatever reason. But they can't quite bear to do it. And I just go, do it, do it. Because if it's true, everyone knows anyway. And it might be an opportunity to sort of sort it out. And if it can never be sorted out, how good is your relationship anyway? Just be brave, do it. And, you know, you're sort of unplugging something so important. But, you know, I was lucky. My mother also extremely, her greatest desire would be that the book was good rather than she came out badly. Although I do find myself sometimes writing, she was the most beautiful woman in the world. No one had ever, and I think, I'm just trying to make sure she doesn't complain about the other things. And, you know, but that works too. That if you make, you can put a bit of that in, it does help. I mean, I would hate to be written about, so I'm amazed when I get quite a lot of, you know, silence from members of my family, and then, you know, the thaw dies and it doesn't take long.
I suppose having a father who is in a sense examining his own experience as well, isn't he, through painting?
Hmm.
I mean, he couldn't really object if you examining your experience, your life experience, through writing. I mean, they're comparable in a sense, aren't they?
Yeah.
And he paints his family and you write about yours.
Yeah. So. I think he couldn't object. It doesn't mean he wouldn't, you know, people are like. But he did once say, I think after one book, it was a similar theme to something, he said, I understand what you're trying to do. He said, it's fine. You can paint a staircase over and over again as long as you know you're painting a staircase. And, you know, I just loved that because it meant, you know, focus on what interests you. It is, you know, endlessly fascinating if it fascinates you, as long as you're aware of it, as long as you're just repeating. So, yeah. Well, he's really, he's a good reader.
I just noticed that that your audience is sort of overwhelmingly female, and I wondered what you thought about that. And also when you were talking earlier about writers that you like, I wondered, kind of slightly arbitrarily, whether you like Michel Houellebecq, who I always think of as being a very male writer, but in some ways deals with sort of similar kind of questions of sexual discovery at young age, isolationism, that kind of thing.
I never have read anything by him, actually. I've often thought of reading something by him and just never have, but I intend to. And I saw a book by him the other day and I thought, I must read something by him. And I'm quite interested in what I've read about him. But I just never have. It just hasn't ever come up for some reason. And in terms of... I know I have male readers, but apparently most readers of fiction, you know, predominantly readers of fiction are female. And so I'm grateful for the male readers that I do have. And I sometimes say this with my covers, if they're particularly female, I sort of say, oh, I feel like we're losing any male readers here. Would they really wander around with a book like this? I even felt that about this book. I sort of felt that, is it just too kind of romantic looking and too, and well, who knows, in the end, this was the cover and I like it now a lot. But it's one of my concerns sometimes with the way books are published, that they can sort of go in that direction. Like, we're going to aim this at the female readership and forget that 20% of men, because, you know, it's just really nice to have a wide readership and it's really interesting. But yeah, it's true. Any literary event, there's usually more women. I don't know exactly why that is, but maybe it's just the novel thing. Men read a lot of non-fiction often, whereas I actually can't read non-fiction for some reason. I just find it so hard to read. I want a story now, that's how I feel.
Spoken. I'm not a psychologist, nor do I have to anything to do with psychology, but Esther, given your heritage, you must feel quite a lot of pressure that you're going to be exposed to psychological fields. If I was you, I would probably be afraid or feel all the eyeballs looking over my shoulder while I'm writing. So my question to you is, how can you kind of withstand the pressure of expectations people might have on you? Possibly, do you distract psychological readers every now and then with a character so that the psychologists are busy for a while so you can write the next 10 pages? Or how do you do that?
That's probably why I don't spend any time thinking about who's reading it, because I'd go totally crazy. And I just don't have to, because I'm just not having those thoughts. Thank God. I'm not thinking, how will someone analyze this? I'm just so concerned at the time with trying to make the sentence work, trying to make the sentence good, trying to find a way of describing exactly how that person looks when they're sleeping, or whatever it is I'm doing to make what I'm trying to say work. It's almost like a craft at that point. You're just trying to make it work, not thinking of the whole product, not thinking, will people think that she's obsessed with her father, that I don't even care, really. I just think, is it a good novel? Will they want to turn the page? Is this bit too slow? Is enough happening? I'm really, really passionate about making a book that works. I know it can never work for everybody because it's so personal. And that's what drives me, not what people think in an analytic way. Although it's always, always interesting, whoever you are, to have your own thoughts. I certainly read books with my own, you know, thoughts about different characters and what I know about the way people behave. And I analyze them in my own way, in a different way from someone else, but it adds to it. And what the lovely thing about reading is that you bring so much of yourself to the book. And what I hope, especially by, it's probably why I concentrate often on just one narrator, is I want the reader to feel as if they are the character. You know, whatever's happening to Lara is happening to them, because usually most of those things have sort of on one level or another happened to you. And that's probably what I really want.
One of the things that I enjoyed in Hideous Kinky was that you seem to start as a storyteller very young. And there's one bit in Hideous Kinky where they've asked you to tell a story, and you tell the story, and I think it's a conversation about two birds. And you tell the story, and it entertains them for a long time, and then one or other of them say something about, but you can't understand birds' language. And it's as if they've done an instant analysis of something and have not really appreciated the story that you have told them. And I'm presuming that that is something about your capacity for storytelling and telling good stories that involve people. And if someone comes in with some analysis of it, it sort of takes away from the story. When we'd finished our psychoanalytic training, we had an early seminar with a senior analyst, Hans Thorner, and he said at the time, don't read any more psychoanalysis for 5 years. Just read literature and read the stories. Mm. There's a lady at the back there wants to say something.
I wondered if you could say in what ways you think your life might have been different if you'd had a different surname.
Well, I feel incredibly lucky that my surname didn't affect me at all. I would say, really, until I started writing. So until I was in my late 20s. So I was brought up not with my father, brought up living in the country. No one ever remarked on it, ever. No one ever mentioned it in my family, strange as that may be. I have to say that when I was about 16 and I moved to London, I had a boyfriend for a very short time, and he said, oh, you're related to some, and I thought, yes, who? I know it's someone. And neither of us could quite think who it was. And we thought, and so I was saying, maybe he'll sort of say who this person is. And he couldn't quite remember, but someone had said, oh, you know, that girl you're seeing, she's, you know, and he couldn't quite remember, but I didn't really know. And we were left in the dark, both of us, for a bit longer. So really, as you can see, no effect. But I'm grateful for that. No one, I can see that it was a product of my father's generation that he absolutely didn't want to gain anything from anything that wasn't created by himself. And actually, having read these letters of his father, written to his father, or written by his father, that I had translated, the son of Sigmund, his youngest son, very similar. He gets invited to talk at a... He's an architect at some convention, but not as an architect, but as the son of Sigmund Freud. And his wife says, absolutely no way. You know, if they want you, go, but don't, you know. And that's always been the attitude of everybody. And so therefore, the only time it's made a difference is when I first was published and I was interviewed, really, I suppose, for the first time people were really interested in it, and then that was the first time.
You said that when you write your novels from a character-driven or emotionally-driven perspective, and I wanted just some kind of idea briefly about whether you choose your character and then the story comes from there, or you choose a situation, or really what is the first spark that kind of ignites in your mind before you start your novel?
It really varies from book to book. Sometimes it is a character or one scene, or like I was saying earlier to John, this idea of this teenage girl who suddenly is more popular than her father, and just seeing this moment of how I imagined it was her, you know, being asked out by a whole group of glamorous people, and her father thinking he was going to be asked out too, and then realizing, oh, he's not, and sort of backing away into the doorway. So like I had this scene, and so that was there, although I knew I'd have to write, you know, 150 pages to get to that. But then with other books, like The Sea House, I got given this huge bag of letters from my father, the letters between his parents, and I knew at that moment that I was going to use that in a book, and I was going to set it in Suffolk. And from that point on, I started thinking, who's going to be in it? Blah, blah, blah. And but it was the letters. I had already been thinking, I want to write a book set in Suffolk because it's a place I love so much. And then the letters, because they had been the people in our family to find Suffolk. I know it existed before, but you know, they went there in the 30s. And so that was that. You know, each book, with my first book, it was literally a desire to write. I didn't think I had anything to write about. I'd been writing for a few years, thinking if I only had something to write about, and I was just writing strange, rambling poems and verses and things. I went to a writing class, and we were told we all had to write something long, a long piece, which for me was anything longer. I'd never written anything longer than about a page and a half. So I wrote 8 pages of, you know, childhood, going to Morocco kind of pages. And everyone was, I could really hear them listening. And I thought, oh, that is interesting. Maybe I could write about that more. So, you know, it's just, each book is different.
Why do you write realist fiction?
As opposed to fantasy.
More language-based or more socially motivated, form-based writing?
Because I really... I read a book recently, which was very successful, just won a prize, and I've forgotten right this minute what it's called, but it's a book all set in the future, and it's a kind of theoretical book, although it's a novel of, you know, if all these terrible things happen, you know, how would people survive and what do they do? I hated it so much because it isn't happening. It's not like that. It's not my experience. Why? It's like setting yourself a problem and then trying to work it out. A lot of people loved it. It won a prize, you know. But for me, it's just not what I like. So I guess you're writing the kind of books you like to read.
I'm not a psychotherapist, but I have spent a good deal of time reading books for publishers and sometimes for film companies. And I have to say that I adored Piteous Kinky, but I think this is one of the most visual books and most promising for a film script that I've come across in ages. And also, I'd like to ask you, you said that that you did workshops with people. Is there any way I can find out about when you do a workshop?
I don't have anything coming up. I'm just thinking. I mean, it's quite random. Someone will ask me. I went and taught a short story writing course at Charleston a few months ago in Sussex. And I don't know. I don't know. No, the answer is... No, because I don't do anything set like that. But I have been thinking about it. I love teaching. So I was thinking about starting up I started doing creative writing myself at the City Lit. You didn't like it. I think it's just the luck of the teacher. I had Michelle Roberts, who's just the most generous and warm, wonderful wonderful teacher, and it really just gave me a space to be free and not judged. So, but I was thinking about something.
It is my unpleasant duty to have to draw this evening to a close. I just wondered, is there anything, John, that you would like to add or say before we finish?
Do I need help?
Well, poor Camadonna. I forgot to ask about that, but anyway.
Esther, is there any last word that you would like to say?
Just to say thank you. It's been a lovely audience, lovely to talk and have such wonderful questions. So thank you for coming. That's